Yes, it's Silence issue. Sorry, Silence issue 290. The big 290. We promised it was going to happen, and here it is. It's the big 290. Oh, who'd
what
have thought it?
A special episode we got planned for you.
Absolutely. My friend, the beast must die. I'm Gary Lactus, by the way, dear listener. Hello. I think we're both feeling quite knackered and downbeat.
Hey.
And it's really odd that we've started it with this tone.
I was going to say, every episode of Silence is someone's first and someone's last.
I think this could be both for many.
I wonder how many times it has been someone's first and last. I like to think fairly often.
Loads. Yeah, definitely.
Because I've definitely had that where people have gone, oh, this is a good podcast, and you listen to like 4 minutes, and you're like, nope, not for me. And I imagine that.
I like the subject matter. I do not like these people's personality.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the thing.
That guy's voice is fucking annoying.
Yeah. Why is that guy talking like that?
Yeah.
And why is his monkey friend laughing at it?
Yeah. Hey, wait a minute. Who's the monkey friend in this? Better not be me. I want to be the annoying voice.
You know, Bobsy.
Oh, yeah. That guy. Who asked that?
That's right.
Someone asked about him coming back on. I'm just going to say right now, he's not coming back on. No way. No way. No, it'd be nice to have Bobsy on, actually.
Yeah. Can you imagine organising it and making it happen?
Oh, yeah.
And recording it?
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
We've already got, like, so many... We've got so much content that we're pumping out all hours of every day. We don't have time for that as well. Because,
absolutely.
Not only do we do our hit, long-running lifestyle comics magazine show, Silence, but we've got some Patreon-only content coming... hot and fast, like a dose of the shits, and that's our new patron only content, Dan and Fraser's Starlight Adventures.
It's got a theme tune.
Yeah. It's got content
and it's got a lot of fun. It's we've decided to do the thing where we play through some adventure game books for girls from the 1980s.
Yeah. And
it's fun.
It's really good. Yeah, and you can only get that by subscribing for as little as $1 a month, and that, I don't know what that equates to, about 2p probably at the moment. So it's really not much. You can donate more, and if you want to donate more, you get no extra content, but you get a special warm feeling. But yeah, it's you get like Starlight Adventures, and you'll get a bunch of other stuff that we've got, and you'll get access to the Silence Archive, which is a whole bunch of great stuff that you can kill the rest of lockdown listening through. Imagine listening to us talking about cancelled comics from 8 years ago. What could be better? I mean, what could be better?
Yes, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure there's some clunkers in there. I realise I haven't actually read that much in the last nearly month since the last podcast. What I have read is stuff I've talked about before. I had a big sort out. I had a big sort out of my comics. The pile beside my bed had I've been putting it off and putting it off. And it got to the point where Lady Lactus was like, can you do something about
it? Yeah, what the fuck is that?
Yeah. Like, there's like a thick layer of dust on some of this shit. It's all secreted in like, it was like 3 or 4 like piles of all just stuff, just fucking stuff. And I had a big look through, and I found the Ryan Brown written Hero Killers. I was like, oh, I remember enjoying that, and I never actually finished that. And I was like, oh, no, I don't have all the issues. So I went and bought them, and I started reading them again, really enjoying them. I said, oh, here's something I can talk about. Talked about it years ago when it came out. I did a search on mindlessones.com, and there it was. I'd already talked about it. So,
oh, I didn't realise that that was a prohibitor of us doing this, because I talk about shit I've read all the time. It's the only thing I talk about.
Yeah, well, but it was just that at that point I was like, oh, no, well, I won't continue reading this so that I can talk about it, you know, stuff like that. I've got a load of new stuff. From Lawn. I got a Lawn bomb.
Oh, yes.
Actually, and I recorded the Lawn. We had another request for the opening of Lawn bombs. Mm. So I thought I would oblige. Shall I play that now?
Play it right now.
Okay. Hello, this is Gary Lactus, and in a rather exciting silence exclusive, I'm recording for the very first time from my son's bedroom, from little Barry Lactus's bedroom. And I'm recording this special extra content because Winty, regular listener Winty, got in touch and he said that he liked the opening of the Lawn bombs. And that was yesterday. Today I picked up a Lawn bomb, and I thought, well, let's make a silence listener's dreams come true, because we're a responsive lot here, and we love the dear listener dearly, dear listener. Right, okay, so most of this I don't remember buying, and this is a pleasant surprise, a nice surprise from my past self. It's the Beautiful Stories for Ugly Children, A Cotton Candy Autopsy. This collects the first two clown stories from Beautiful Stories for Ugly Children, which I must have read like getting on for 30 years ago, and it also has a conclusion, so it's like a sort of trilogy of stories. I'm looking forward to reading that. Text pieces, pencil drawings, yeah, lovely dark clown stories, perhaps a bit overdone nowadays, but back in, when did this come out, 89 I think there was still room for dark clowns. Yeah. As ugly children, we found this book extremely beautiful. Penn and Teller. What is it about clowns? They seem to be happy enough bunch, delighted to suffer a pie in the face or a seltzer down the pants just to make us laugh. But what dark compulsion drives these men to hide behind their painted-on smiles and big rubber noses? What madness turns a man into a clown? A Cotton Candy Autopsy follows a group of down-on-their-luck clowns as they escape a conflagration they may well have caused, on their trek to find death, madness, love, redemption, and finally, hope. Forced to uncover the humanity buried beneath the pain and the grease paint, each member of this diverse band ultimately finds the absolution he was searching for when he first set out on the road. Well, that's spoilers, isn't it? Anyway, I look forward to reading that, if I get the time. Next up, I've got a bunch of deadlines. I've been looking at deadlines on eBay recently, and so they're going for a lot of money, and generally not selling. So it's nice to get a bunch of these at a reasonable price. Looking at them, yes, I think I've got some of these already. It's issues 12, which I've definitely got. That's got the Amen, the Shaky Cane Amen on the cover. Lots of nice work in here. I've got that one already. Number 8, I don't think I've got this. This has got a Simon Bisley cover. Free Fuzzbox record offer. This has got it's got Tank Girl, it's got Hot Triggers by Philip Bond, and
Wired World. So it's got, in fact, it's got another one by Philip Bond, and a single pager drawn by Philip Bond and written by Alan Martin in it. So it's a Bond heavy piece. Interview with Simon Bisley and Pat Mills. It's got a lot of the usuals: Hugo Tate, Beryl the Bitch, Sid Serene as well. Sid Serene by Anoniman, who was he was the guy who drew whose style changed later in life, and drew Cradle Grave. But this early stuff's really nice. It's really nice. It's almost got a sort of Tony Riott feel to it. A really lovely line. I think Cradle Grave was a lot more photo-reft. But this looks lovely. As I remember, it was a challenging read, Sid Serene. Kind of poetic, I guess. But it's really lovely artwork. Edmund Bagwell. Yeah. Good stuff. Lovely Johnny Nemo there. Brett Ewins. Ron Merlin's Paradigm Shift. Ron Merlin was Brett Ewins, I think. Oh, man, I love Deadline. That question, if you had a time machine, what period of time would you like to go back to? Obviously, I'd like to go back and do something about this pandemic. But failing that, I'd like to go back to this period in time, early Deadline, and do my best to draw real good and be part of it, I think. And hang out in Worthing with Hewlett and Bond and Martin and all of that. Anyway, lovely stuff. Got issue 5 there as well. I think I may have that one as well, but there we go. The problem I have is, like, I see something that I like, and because things get snapped up so quickly, I go, yes, I'll have it, yes, I'll have it. And because my collection is in such disarray at the moment and is obscured by a ladder, I'm not one of these people who keeps lists of their stock. So, not their stock, the collection. I guess it is stock, because I'd like to sell a lot of it. So I just have to go, yes, please. Starcrossed here. Starcrossed by the short-lived Helix imprint, DC Comics Helix. It was a science fiction imprint. The idea was it was Vertigo with a science fiction bent. I guess Vertigo being a horror bent. And yeah, this is a 3-issue series by Matt Howarth. And I got the first one, and I remember this, you know, when it came out in 1997, and I remember thinking, it just doesn't look right coloured in, his stuff. And looking at it again, yes, I think it probably would look better in black and white. But still, it's Matt Howarth that I haven't got. He doesn't appear to be making stuff now, so I look forward to reading those. Strange Alien Societies, flicking through here. It's got all the Howarth hallmarks of novel sound effects and a great many bits of sort of thick hatching. Very nice. Lots of asteroids. What's this? DC 1 million. I never read this. And it's by Morrison. Conceived by Grant Morrison. I thought I'd give it a read, you know. I'm not particularly excited about it. But it's nice to have. If I fancy reading a bit of superheroics, cosmic superheroics, then I can just pick this up. and read it. Sweatshop, issue 3. Now, I'm hoping this is an issue I don't have. It's a Pete Bag written thing, drawn by Stephen DiStefano. Stephen DiStefano. And very much drawn in a Pete Bag style. And this, as I remember what I've read of this, I really enjoyed. It's sort of some people set in a sort of in a cartoon studio with a sort of head cartoonist. I get the impression it's a kind of a Jim, what's his name? Jim Davis, Garfield type setup. That sort of thing. There's a guy at the top who created it, and he does no work, and he's got lots of sort of minions doing stuff for not much pay. Anyway, I'm glad I've got that. Have I got it already? Hey, it'll go back to Lorne. Oh, there's a delivery. That was the postman there. And, oh, look at this. That's just literally just arrived. It's arrived to me. It's a large letter. If undelivered, please return to Paul Milne. So, this is exciting, isn't it, dear listener? This is Paul John Milne's latest mega comic. I'm not treating this packaging with respect because I'm desperate to get at it. I won't be using this envelope again. It is Grave Horticulture, number 3. There's a lovely sort of poster here, which I've managed to slightly rip in my enthusiasm to get at the inside package, with some lovely muscly chainsaw people with cyber headsets and techno-organic guns and sound effects, all running around looking like they're having a lovely fight. And a brilliant a Rob Liefeld Youngblood bubblegum card. Who's this guy then? Who's this? Oh, hello, Ivor the Galactica. Each issue of Youngblood is in the flip format. It begins with a cover and 12 interior pages about one team. Flip it over and there's another cover and 12 pages about the other team. Youngblood by Image Comics. What a treat. Grave Horticulture. Wow. Oh, this is thick. This is thick. Well, I mean, I'll probably talk about this properly at some point, but I can tell you, on the back here, it says, imagine someone had taken the raw meat of early Vertigo and, more generally, all of 90s comics excess and put that meat through a mincer. I'm very happy to be lost in the meaty world of Grave Horticulture. That's a quote from Fraser Giessen, a.k.a. Gary Lactus, creator of The Cleaner, Journey to the Surface of the Earth, and Silence here, which he's written not all in all caps, unfortunately. Well, what a piece of shit Paul John Milne is. Moving on. I'm very excited about that. Does it end? Is that the end? Is that it? Is that the last issue? I don't want to spoil it by looking at the end. Oh, we've got some issues of Hellblazer here. Back to the Lawn Bomb now. Issues 9 and 10. They look familiar. I think possibly because I have them in Titan collections. Got one with art by Richard Piers Rayner. I wonder what happened to him. He was a good sort of burger comics artist. And John Ridgway, the sort of the early regular artist. Does he have a different... Yeah, he's being inked by someone else here. It's nice, actually. John Ridgway and Alfredo Alcala, artists. Oh, I don't know. I wonder how they're divvying up the duties there. But it works well from a flick through. Nice. And again, I don't think I have that number 9 there. Oh, it's got the first appearance of Swamp Thing turning up. I think this is the first time Swamp Thing turned up and John Constantine smoked a bit of him. That's something that was reprised on his 40th birthday, I think, when Garth Ennis was writing. There we go. A little bit of historic moment. I wonder if it's worth more for being the first time John Constantine smoked a bit of Swamp Thing. More Pirate Corps. I've got Pirate Corps issue 3 here, and I previously got a compilation of 1 and 2. So I've got three issues. That's exciting. And it's always got a bit of milk and cheese there as well, for fun. Let's have a look. Bunch of the Wade and Wieringo era Fantastic Four. Pretty sure I'm missing some of these. Pretty sure I've got some of them as well. I think this is my favourite run on the Fantastic Four. Just good, solid family fun. And what else have we got? 2021, Lost Children. It's 2021 now. From Statics Press, which was a Titan Comics imprint that reprinted Bande Dessinée. And this is a bit of an impulse because it's got a James Stokoe cover. And it's a bit misleading because you open it up and it's a lot of photo reference sort of digital painting style stuff. And when did this come out? 2012, I think. Oh no, that's when it was originally published. I don't know when this came out. It was when Milligan's Prisoner, The Prisoner, was coming out. And other stuff. But I think I remember back in the days when I had sponsorship, I think I remember picking this up and kind of not finishing it. But I'll give that a go at some point. Because these Statics Press things, I like pretty much everything they put out. Because, of course, the French are better at doing comics. In general, I would say. And it's just so weird that we don't get to read that much of it. Unless we can, you know, unless we know French. Who knows French? This is Great Britain. We don't know French. We don't speak French. Right, lovely. I expect there'll be a few things going into the resale pile. But on the whole, what a lovely lawn bomb. Okay, back to the main show now.
And there it is, another great lawn bomb. Well, of course, you haven't heard that.
No, the Beast no idea dying. what you've got.
Yeah, yeah. It was just sort of 5 minutes of constant slagging you off, really.
And then I laughed.
But it was amazing. Whilst I was doing the lawn bomb, the postman arrived and gave me Grave Horticulture issue 3 from... you know, your pal and mine. Get it right, Gary. Paul John Milne. He is not Jean-Paul.
Jean-Paul.
He is Paul John.
He is our Gajan friend. Jean-Paul Milne. He is like Gavis. Yes. He wears a special headband and has electronic cards he fires out of his stupid fucking hands.
Yes, mon ami, he is better than Gambit because, of course, he has huge muscles and bigger veins.
mon frère.
Yeah, That was a treat. So yeah,
what our Cajun accents? I think that was a treat, but yeah, I suppose yeah. That comic was probably all right. Probably. is there anything else we need to do up front?
I have been devouring audiobooks.
Tell me about that.
I did. Well, first off, I did John Cooper Clarke's autobiography. I think it's called Let Me Be Yours. Really good.
Yeah.
Really big and long and good and read by him.
He's got a great voice as well. It's like, you know, anyone would think he'd actually made a career out of his voice in some way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, fantastic. I mean, aside from anything, I was reminded of his Sugar Puffs adverts.
Oh, shit.
From the late 80s.
Yeah, right.
Really good. Yeah.
Have you, fantastic adverts. The thing I took away from his 600-page biography was his adverts from the 80s. Have you experienced Cooper Clarke before this? Is he someone that you like?
No, not really. And, you know, I know that there's a poem called Beasley Street that everyone likes and stuff like that. I've never engaged with his poetry. It was... I'll tell you what it was. I was listening to the Adam Buxton podcast and he said that he'd been listening to it and he said he was enjoying it. And I was like, oh, pfft, I've got like, because I haven't been doing the cleaning work. I've started again because my financial situation has changed once again. So I had just a bunch of credits on Audible.
Well,
and I thought, oh, well, I'll get that. Oh, look, that's a decent length. At least, you know. I've seen him in interviews and stuff. I've never seen him perform.
Mm.
And I've never really engaged with his work. But I bloody loved it. Really good.
Mm.
Takes you right through the... Because he's quite old. You know, he was... he had a sort of a reasonably mature vantage point on punk. Right through the 60s, trying to be in bands and stuff. Just his description of... products and clothes are really vivid. It's sort of like time travel, right from like, you know, late, you know, rock and roll, late 50s, right through the 60s, through the 70s, you know, how much he didn't like the whole prog thing. Really good. And just well-written, propulsively written and... really, really vivid and descriptive as well. It's like time travel. Well, because it's a book, you could almost call it tome travel.
Oh, that's good. That's a great joke.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He did. He worked in... this is not comics at all. But he was like, I want to be a poet. And his mum was like, you know, well, what poet has ever made any money? And he said, like, one of the main... inspirations was an encouraging motivation was wash her face, who talks like that?
Pam Ayres,
because she was on telly and making money out of poetry. She's like, oh, there we go, we do that. And what's that dead fat comic who was really sexist and racist? Bernard Manning's Club. He started doing poetry at Bernard Manning's Club. Yeah, in Manchester. Just insane.
Mm.
But went down all right and started making money. Yeah, incredible story. It does the whole junkie thing, you know.
Yeah.
But... His recollection is fine, and he was a functioning addict.
A bit like coke, although coke was never like heroin. But you know, he manages to write entertainingly about being, you know, hopelessly addicted to various substances or whatever.
I highly recommend.
I have to say, if you want a sample of a good sample for listening to him, you know, his stuff. Just get, he did like a couple of records with for Factory Records, And he was sort of backed by a sort of all-stars band. I think it was like Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks and produced by Martin Hannett.
But the Invisible Girl.
Snap, Crackle and Bop, that record, which has got Beasley Street and it's got Conditional Discharge and Chicken Town, and it's great. It's a really great pop record. Like, it's got this immensely, like, I don't know, like, excellent but quite melodic post-punk backing to these, to his kind of intonations. But it's actually like a really catchy sort of pop record with really excellent, like, his poetry, really. And I love it. It's like something I go back to really quite often. If you want to kind of listen to him but not have to go, oh shit, where do I start? I think that's a good start point, basically.
I might check that
out. I think you would enjoy it myself. I think you would enjoy the music, and I think you would enjoy the sounds on top of the music. And it all slips down.
That's the two things about music that I like.
The music and the stuff that goes on top. When I grow up, I want to be the person who puts stuff on top of music. You mean a singer? Yes, one of those.
Well, when I grow up, I want to be the music that does the stuff underneath the stuff that goes on top.
We should get together. We could form
a band. Yes.
That's how McCartney and Paul Lennon got together, isn't it? They did that.
Yeah, absolutely. Those four Scouser Leverpudlian lads from Liverpool and Mersey.
Bobby Lennon, Jingo McCartney, Basher Harrison and Sneezy Star. That's the ones, I think, isn't it?
There was so much in that book about the sort of history and evolution of rock and roll. I actually found it made quite a good companion piece to Andrew Hickey's History of Rock Music in 500 Songs podcast, which I enjoy. Perhaps you would, dear listener. Mm. Our dear friend, Andrew Hickey. But that was a roundabout way of saying that I've got round to the Stan Lee biography. That new Stan
Lee. Is it
Lee
being read biography. By Stan Lee?
No, it isn't. Oh. It's read by a guy. I don't know who his name is.
I can't believe they didn't ask you, if I'm honest.
I could have done, like, there's so many quotes. You
could
know,
you do
he
some
quoted
select
so
readings
much in it.
For bonus Patreon content? I mean, no, obviously not, because that would be just copyright theft, but but yes.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, it could get a bit complicated.
Could
that. In many ways, yeah. It's all right. It's very thorough.
Yeah,
it's very thorough. The guys clearly had access to the Stan Lee archive,
right?
And he's gone right through it. And there's even like sort of notebooks of stuff.
Ah.
In the late 70s, and just one thing that stuck out today, I haven't finished listening to it, it's like 15 hours long or something.
Right. Oh, wow, it's
but,
proper. Legit.
When he was sort of put in charge of the whole magazine and everything, he was sort of in charge of all publishing for a little while, he was brainstorming some ideas. There's these like sort of pages and pages of ideas about, like, you know, movies and magazines and stories, novels. And one of them is a magazine idea called Fannies, which it's just pictures, both clothed and naked, of men and ladies' bottoms. Fannies.
But then
he wrote that down. At some point, he thought that, and he wrote it down. thinking, you know, maybe there's something in it.
I also like the idea that he's like, I want to launch Fannies in the UK. It's like, it's going to have to change a little bit. It's going to be the front instead.
He's going to have to turn it around. Yeah.
Maybe he could have done, this is a great idea, and it's coming to me right now, a Flip magazine, US side, just the bums. Flip it over for the UK side, exactly the same bums, but you get the front bums instead.
That sounds fantastic.
Fannies UK and Fannies US.
Yeah, man, I was pouring a little bit of scorn on that idea, wasn't I? But turns out he was a genius.
He was a genius. And,
No, I mean, you know, there's no sort of surprise.
Is it well written? Is it kind of engaging, or is it sort of?
Yes, it is. Right. Yeah, it is. Although, he has to, obviously, because everything he's talking about is so contested. He has to present Stan Lee's version and the contested, Kirby version, the Ditko version, and all of these other things. And he does have to get quite inventive with the amount of times he has to say, perhaps, or maybe.
It is alleged.
Or, So I think I mean, I don't know, I haven't done the research the author's done, but it does an all right job of, presenting all the different sides of everything.
I'm glad you put that caveat in that you haven't done as much research as the author, because I think our listeners would have been a bit like, well, Gary's pretty thorough with his research, so I'm not sure where I come down on this fence.
Yeah, right. Well, obviously, I realise how much our listeners look up to me, my process.
Yeah, tell us about diligence. Can you talk a bit about your process?
Yeah, sure. my process is I kind of live my life, and then I live it again and again and again every day. Every day takes about a week, and I live every day until I'm sure that I've really lived that day, and taking copious notes and voice memos along the way. And at the end of 2 weeks, I've had my day, and for some reason, my wife is kind of frustrated with me and my process. But it's the process.
It's the process.
I've got to live my life. I've got to pot my casts in a diligent way, which is my heart belongs to the dear listener.
Exactly.
Okay? Yeah. And people have got to understand that,
Yeah, it's the process, man. It's the process.
Yes.
You know what I always say, buddy?
And who are your guys?
It ain't life that's gonna kill you, it's the back matter. I always say that.
You always say that. I remember you said that for an entire month.
I did.
Once.
Yeah,
and then didn't you?
My wife left me. But it was worth it, because it's such a good thing to say. I watched something, so it's time for silence. Silence, the film has started. That's what it is, yeah. I watched, and it's comic-related. Don't worry, dear listener, in case you're thinking, but when are you going to get to comics? It's what I come here for. I watched, what's it called now? It's called The Emancipation of The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harlene Quinn, or Harley Quinn. A.K.A. Birds of Prey. The Birds of Prey movie is what I watched.
Right, okay.
I watched it with Lady Ms. Beast, and she doesn't like superhero films, really, and I don't really like superhero films, so we knew it was going to be a good night. But no, we just wanted a bit of a kind of, let's have a bit of wham bam, please, it's Friday night sort of thing. So we stuck it on.
Something with a neighbour's connection. Yeah,
exactly.
I understand
you
know your motivations.
It's got to have a neighbour's connection. And I'd heard reasonably positive things, but got quite well reviewed, and a few people I know and like on Twitter had enjoyed it, and I knew it was directed by a woman. And I'm not just going to be shit and go, "It was directed by a woman." Fuck it, I'll try and find out exactly who.
Starring, of course, full name, Margaret Robert.
Kathy Yan, directed by Kathy Yan. So, you know, I was interested. Basically, I really like the Birds of Prey. I've not read any of the Birds of Prey comics, but I like the idea of it. I think there's no reason. It's like Suicide Squad. There's no reason that shouldn't be a good setup. You know, Huntress, Poison Ivy, or whatever it is. You know, all that gang. Can't remember. It's not that in there, but you know.
Yeah, all these like, not that in the comics.
Yeah, it's just all of them hanging out, doing some low level, medium level, you know, work for hire kind of stuff. I quite like that, and you know, Oracle, Barbara Gordon, all that. Yeah, fun, no problems. Same with the Suicide Squad. There's no reason that shouldn't make for an enjoyable film. And for about, I don't know, 3 minutes, this was like I enjoyed it because it's got a really sort of bracing, postmodern, winky winky tone, and it is definitely like you can feel like a female viewpoint in a way that you really don't in the majority of these superhero films. And having spent a lot of time, so in Suicide Squad movie, David Ayer's compromised and dreadful Suicide Squad movie, which I still have a weird amount of affection for because it's the first thing I did after my daughter was born. The first time I left the house in any kind of meaningful way was to go and see Suicide Squad with a mate, because he was like, do you want to go see it? And I was similar.
It was like the one like sort of social thing I did when I did Edinburgh that year.
Just a thing.
I went with Phil Gerrard, and it was just nice to go to the cinema with a friend.
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly it. And I was sort of a bit tired, and I just sat and went, oh, yeah, I like this, even though I knew it was dreadful. But anyway, Margot Robbie in that is really good. She does a lot with a little. She's a very, very good actress, and she is very compelling and all that stuff. But, you know, that film spends an awful lot of time staring at her arse in hot pants and being like, Harley Quinn. And this film goes sort of to redress that a bit. And actually, there's a much more of a sort of, it's a much more empowered film in many, many ways. And there is stuff to enjoy, for sure. But it really felt cheap. It really, really felt cheap to me. In a way that wasn't charming. It just was like, oh, this is like, there's not much money here. There's probably shitloads of money really behind it, but there's still not enough money to make it work. It's got a really bad performance by Ewan McGregor, who plays Black Mask, you know, the Batman baddie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I mean, I've always had my suspicions that Ewan McGregor is actually just a really bad actor. But this was like full blown, like, are you being camp? I don't know. I think you're trying to be camp, but I can't tell. And it's genuinely one of the top 10 worst performances I think I've seen in a mainstream film. Really bad. And it really, a lot hinges on him because he's like the main baddie, and it really is a fucking mess. And, you know, like, you've got people, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who you'd recognise from things like Scott Pilgrim and maybe Death Proof, the Tarantino film. She plays the Huntress. You have Journey Smollett is the Black Canary. And, you know, it's a different read on Black Canary. I quite like it. Rosie Perez as Renee Montoya. You know, there's lots to enjoy here, theoretically. But it just doesn't know. There's too many people in it. Doesn't know what to do with them. It can't maintain its tone. It's kind of exhausting because it's trying to be so sort of endlessly weirdly sort of peppy and sort of look at me and it just didn't land. And after a while I was just like, this is kind of terrible actually. And I wanted to like it, and I think it was different. Again, it was different. It took a swing. It just didn't land. And ultimately, like all these things, after a while you're just like, I've tuned out now. And I think it just sort of, it couldn't commit one way or another. It wasn't quite, you know, like people rag on like Joel Schumacher's Batman and Robin, and they should in some ways, because it came at the end of, you know, like Burton started off with an idea, and by the time it got to Schumacher's Batman and Robin, it's like, what the fuck is this? Halfway between the sort of 60s camp and the weird gothic whimsy of Burton and all this stuff. But actually, you look back at that, and like, Joel Schumacher understands camp quite well. And actually, there's a huge amount to enjoy in that film if you just go, okay, right, now look at it. Isn't this fucking wonderful? Look at these ridiculous sets. Look at the way that Batman's suit has nipples. Look at like how incredibly bad every performance is, and yet that because Schumacher understands camp well, it kind of is probably like a pretty enjoyable watch. And something like this, I felt like it just didn't know where to put itself. It was trying to be lots of things and it didn't land. And it's a shame because actually, again, I think a slightly more serious film with a kind of like a sort of fourth wall breaking, like lunatic as the main character would work quite well. Like Margot Robbie's such a kind of ball of energy in this kind of, she really inhabits this sort of twitchy psycho persona. And it's very, you know, it's comic book level stuff. But I think she should have been the thing. I think the film itself should have gone for a bit more of a grit. I think it kind of just, like there's all these bits set in the Black Mask Club, but it just looks, I mean, it literally looks like they've just put some stuff on the wall of a warehouse and gone, it's a nightclub. So there's just people dancing around, but there's just no sense of it being a nightclub. It really looks like a cheap set, and that kind of lack of visual imagination is just peppered throughout it. So it's aspiring for this kind of poppy, you know, plasticky wow fun experience, and it just doesn't land. It just looks so fucking cheap, basically.
What is it? I mean, this is something I've noticed about stuff. Like I've like with a lot of the Marvel films, I've seen them at the cinema, and I enjoy them for the, you know, the confections that they are, you know, the sweet empty calories that they are, and quite often I've kind of rewatched them at home, and that is when you really notice like bad CGI. You notice it more on a TV than on a big screen.
Yeah.
And that seems counterintuitive. I've never really understood why that is, because like surely on a big screen it's like, you know, it's more detailed, you know, it's all there laid out in front of you. Something about the noise and the spectacle seems to mask that. And a lot of stuff like Black Panther, a lot of that really does look quite bad on a television.
Yeah.
A lot of the CGI just totally didn't mind it in the totally accepted it in a cinema. It's odd. I don't understand what the perceptive jiggery pokery is.
there's really quite a bad level of CGI now. It's like it's incredibly shit. Like I feel that in time it will really age in the way that, like, certain, so if you watch like King Kong from 1933, even though it's like, yes, it's wobbly and shaky and it's sets and miniatures and all that stuff, there is a real like mastery of the craft on display, right? And that film still has an incredible energy and is incredibly well put together and is still really exciting. But if you watch other similar films that aspire to that from then and a bit later, they can often look incredibly shit. Like if you watch like a Roger Corman thing, I was like, it's just like, oh yeah, like, this is just, it all looks incredibly like, and I really feel CGI is going to be like that. So these films that cost like just hundreds of million, they just look so shit sometimes. You're like, you know, it just, there's a, like, I watch.
But I think as time goes on, people will, you know, will reappraise that again. And, you know, quite possibly. I mean, some people will. Someone will. It's inevitable.
I think CGI is an aesthetic which will snap into focus, actually, and people will begin to like appreciate it in the way that like I appreciate rubber and prosthetic effects from the 1980s. In the way that like I think people will start to, you know, really determine aspects of it that they really like, and you know, things that, like, even though it's not great, they like the kind of aesthetic of it or something like that. I think it will become that. But it is interesting. It's just an interesting thing. Like, as you say, like, sometimes you're watching like this massive film and you're like, this just looks terrible. You're watching it at home and it's so dislocating because you're like, nothing feels like it's happening at all. You know, but I watched the Luc Besson film Valerian and the 12 Planets of Mystery or whatever it is. I can't remember. I loved it. You know, it's an absolute load of nonsense, and it's like totally the most Euro thing since, well, The Fifth Element, really. But I mean, it's.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed gorgeous. That as well. It's, you know, so
it's
busy,
fucking gorgeous. Yeah. It looks amazing, and it's because he commits 100% to the aesthetic and just leans into it. And so, you know, none of that stuff is happening. It's all happening, you know, in digital, you know, post. And but it's just really committed, and it just completely, you know, transports you, even though it's complete nonsense. And you know,
yeah,
just,
yeah, and the characters are sort of, you know, sort of cardboard cutouts, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I never really understood what their relationship was.
No.
What their motivations were, anything like that. I was just going, oh, this looks really nice.
Yeah. It was good for tired people, that film.
Yeah.
Really good. Anyway, so that's Birds of Prey. Not great. Wanted to like it. I mean, I quite like the fact that DC films swing wildly for, you know, different tones and occasionally land and mostly don't. But there is something like pleasingly oddball about their kind of crazy careening approach. You know, the way they'll be like, oh, the Joker, I mean, this worked. I mean, I fucking hated it, but it worked and it was very different. And then, you know, it's like, compare that to Shazam and then put that against Birds of Prey and then look at Justice League and then, oh, now we've got another Justice League, the Snyder Cut. Oh, have you seen the trailer for that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should watch the trailer for that.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Not interested.
No, but you should still watch it just for the just the seriousness of it is worth a watch. Like really, like, you know, I watched about half of Man of Steel the other day, and I was like, I do quite like the way Snyder's just like, I am very serious all the time. And it's like he really imbibed all that like dark stuff from the 80s that, you know, Moore and Miller ushered in without any understanding of the playfulness of it at all. Like, none. Not one bit. He's like...
Yeah. He's a prestige format director.
I bet he fucking loves Arkham Asylum. I bet he loves Arkham Asylum. I bet he is just like, that is how Batman should be done. That is the, you know, somewhere between Year One and Arkham Asylum. But I secretly think it's Arkham Asylum. You know, it's that sort of very serious. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm going to, as me and... Lord Nutting and Savage would describe, he described it as an incredulous hate watch. Definitely, like, I'm so fascinated. I think I'm way more in the can for this than you are. I want 4 hours of Scott Snyder's relentlessly serious but utterly committed vision of the Justice League, which is nothing like the one that I would want to see in some ways. But I like the fact that he cares that much. He's like, bring it on. But yeah, check out the tone. See what you think.
Okay. I mean, we could do a live watch now if you want.
It's probably about 10 probably minutes long. You know,
All right, let's not do that.
so many trailers now are very long. Very long. They're like, really? Yeah. Right, shall we talk about some comics?
Doing the exit. Sorry, let's start again.
You're ready to go home.
I already want to get out of the review universe. Right.
Come with us to review universe with Gary and the Beast and you, of course.
I did hand movements then. I was on my own, but I did hand movements.
I gripped my knees.
Oh, I was doing sort of
and
swirling, presenting hands as though I was presenting to an audience. It was quite committed. There is no audience. Yes.
No.
It's you.
Hello, Tam.
Hi, Tam. Hi, Winty.
And all of the other dear listeners.
Yes.
Right. Tell me about a thing. I know you've already talked a load about a thing.
Yeah, but Tom, do some more talking. I will. Yeah, thanks for inviting me on to talk.
Thank you.
I read a Spider-Man comic from the 1980s, which is one of the defining Spider-Man texts. Now, I really like Spider-Man. I realise this. I really like him. I think he's one of the greats. I know, that's a hot take. He's one of the greats.
What?
Yeah, no.
You like Spider-Man?
But it's funny, like, my actual reading of Spider-Man is so limited. You know, I think the most consistent Spider-Man I ever read was in the, like, early 90s. They did, still do this, but they were, like, British reproductions. Like, the complete Spider-Man came out. And it was, like, all four. And it was launched on the back of the immense popularity of the Todd McFarlane Spider-Man. So there'd be, like, his Spider-Man, Spectacular Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, and Web of Spider-Man in every issue. And it'd be like £2. And I didn't really want it because I was really into 2000 AD and Grant Morrison, blah, 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 all that shit. But I was like, it was available.
You're living in a village and you've got...
or your mum went to the supermarket and it'd be like, wait in the car, read this. You know, so it was sort of... It was there, and I do remember really digging, like, just A, the Rogues Gallery, but also the sort of meat and potatoes-ness of Spider-Man stories. They are quite sort of, there's something very quintessential about reading a Spider-Man story, at least certain ones from a certain era. Like, it really is, like, almost more than Batman, really, like the urtext of what I think of as a superhero story, as a Spider-Man story. It's like, you know, it's in a city. You've got your Peter Parker. He's like, oh, he's a bit troubled, bit of a geek, bit of a, you know, oh, but he's got his lovely girlfriend and he's got his special powers. His boss hates him. Oh, no. Oh, no, he's gone to work. Oh, no, someone's turned up and now he's got to fight the Rhino. And here's all these other, like, fun soap opera stuff. But you know what I mean? It's like when I think of, like, a sort of Jerry Conway written Spider-Man with, like, a John Buscema artwork or something with Doc Ock and Spider-Man. That feels like such a sort of, like, that is a superhero comic. So he, although I haven't read that much of him, I do love him really. You know, he's certainly my favourite Marvel guy, I guess, in a way. Maybe, I don't know, who fucking cares. Anyway, I read Kraven's Last Hunt, which is the seminal, I think it's like 6-part series that ran across a bunch of Spider-Man titles in the 80s, late 80s. J.M. DeMatteis written and Mike Zeck drawn. And
yeah, I've never read it.
Yeah, and I've never read it, but it's always name-checked as one of the core sort of, you know, the texts in a way. It's like, oh yeah, you know, that's a great Spider-Man story, that one. And it deals with Kraven, who is an amazing character. So I want to call him John Kravenoff, but he's not called that. He's like the son of, like, faded Russian aristocracy, who is like a hunter, and he spends an awful lot of time charging around his mansion. Basically, he's a sort of aristo who believes that the world's gone to shit, and he's trying to kind of get back to a sort of more noble savagery. So he's just always, like, in his pants, and he spends quite a lot of time fighting with stuffed animals in his mansion. It's really odd. But he's wonderful. He's sort of, you know, mustachioed. He spends a lot of time either naked or just in a loincloth, and he's intensely fucking serious and really, like pompous. And basically it concerns him because he sort of, as a hunter, he needs to best Spider-Man. Having been bested by him, having never quite, you know, bested him, he sets up this kind of ultimate plan to finally beat Spider-Man. He doesn't kill him, he just beats him. He kind of wins, and he buries him alive and takes on the mantle of Spider-Man, dresses as him and goes out, like as though he's almost like he's kind of like drunk the blood of the slain victor and he's going out and stuff. And
so you take the lion's head waistcoat or like bolero jacket off.
Yeah, no, he's just dressed as Spider-Man but with that on top. and what's interesting about this is that essentially, oh, and it also has this parallel story about this sort of monstrous carrion. Not carrion, vermin, who is like this sort of half rat, half man guy who lives in the sewers. And yeah, it's a lot of stuff about man and beast and spider totems. J.M. DeMatteis, full-blown 80s pretentious mode. And this is post Moore and Miller kind of times take on Spider-Man. It's definitely aspiring for that kind of we can be serious too. But you know, DeMatteis has been around for a long time and he's got his own, he's always been a serious writer. He was like behind like Blood and Moonshadow and things like that. So in a way he's kind of one of the old school in his own way of this. So it's not totally aping, but it's definitely got that kind of Miller, Moore, lots of purple prose and captions, very serious. But it's also like anchored to this really genuinely wonderful Mike Zeck artwork. And I mean, this is like, I completely was just like, oh, I get why people fucking love this guy. And he's inked by, I think it's Bob McLeod, I think. Hold on, sorry. I mean, yeah, Bob McLeod. Really, and you know sometimes when an inker is incredibly sensitive to a penciler and it just comes together really beautifully and you're getting all the like depth and texture that a good penciler's bringing, but the inker's kind of bringing that richness out, and it's just a really good job. There's something almost, although it's incredibly dynamic and pneumatic superhero artwork, it's also got kind of shades of like Will Eisner in the way that, you know, the rainy city is portrayed, the sort of texture, the shadow. It's really good, and I was really loving reading it. And the storytelling's immaculate. And
you say this was originally run across a bunch of Spider-Man titles?
Yeah, it ran across. I think they it was the
and
first
it's the
time.
Same, it's the same team, so it doesn't swap between artists.
No, and it caused, they were going to run that it helps. In Amazing Spider-Man, and then they ran it across like Amazing, Spectacular, and Web. And it was like it juiced the sales on all of them because it was a real immediate hit. But also it was quite controversial because people were like, fuck you, I don't want to like buy these other ones and stuff. So it's one of the first times it was like this kind of, I don't know, this sort of cheating the system in a way. And but the other reason that this is quite like, yeah, this is like in some ways one of the quintessential like superhero melodrama text. Like it's so melodramatic and it's so overwrought, but it's genuinely quite wonderful. I really enjoyed reading it, and I really enjoyed how seriously it takes itself, but how when it's married, because it's not like Dave McKean or someone drawing it, it's married against this proper superhero artwork, it feels right. It feels like this is kind of what superhero comics should and could be in a way. Is this, they need to retain that kind of melodrama, and they need to retain that pulpiness, and they need to be like serious but ridiculous at the same time. And you know, this is the kind of thing that a 12-year-old is going to read and be like, yes, such a grown-up read. But as a 40-something reading it, I could totally get into it still, even though it was sort of preposterous and overwritten and silly. It's also just like, it's great, and it's so comicsy, and it uses the form. It could only be a comic. It doesn't feel, it's not aspiring for cinematic. It's pure comics. And it's also Batman. It's also Spider-Man in a black suit, which I really love. It's one of the few, you know, alterations to a character where I'm like, I think this is kind of almost better than the original, the black suit. I love it. I think it's such a strong.
Yeah, role. Yeah. Well, that was, you know, that was kind of my Spider-Man.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it was Secret Wars that got me properly into the wider Marvel universe. Mm. And following that, you know, the UK Spidey comics. And, yeah, that was like, that was the one that when I was, you know, 8 years old, that's the one I would draw. The black one. Great to draw as well.
Yeah, really. Really
good,
yeah.
Lot less hassle to draw.
But what I quite like is in this is that the, you know, that Zek and McLeod, like they really give the sense of the kind of shininess of the suit. They don't just cop for the like, oh, it's all just a black shape. It's like you really get this kind of blue, shiny quality to the black suit as well. But the other reason that this is quite a controversial storyline is it ends, spoilers, okay, everyone, spoilers, it ends with essentially Craven best Spider-Man. Spider-Man gets out. It's one of the great fucking panels is Spider-Man bursting out of the grave, like pulling himself out of the grave. And that's just fucking awesome. And it's great because it riffs on
echoing the Ditko.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very Ditko. I mean, this is, Zek is channeling
it's Spider-Man 33, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's, I mean, it's fucking beautiful. It's one of those pages where you're like, I'd have that on my wall. It's lovely, even though I know you don't agree with that. But anyway, so essentially Craven wins, you know, and the defeat, the fall of Craven is that he realizes the essential hollowness of his victory. And he's sort of realizes essentially that he's just mad and that actually he hasn't
run That's anything. A very Dematis thing.
It's very like Dematis, that. Yeah. And he ends up killing himself. And so he actually shoots himself and it ends with this suicide. Which, you know, that if that was pulled off now, it wouldn't be such a shock because, you know, people are just used to that in media. But in, like, 1986 or 7 or whatever it was, that's pretty shocking. It's like, you know, it's like one of the Sinister Six blows his brains out and that's the end of him. And the reaction was apparently quite strong to this. And because of the ambiguity with which Dematis brings to the tale, and he does, you know, he's a decent writer, Dematis. I've got a lot of time for him. He overwrites and he can be incredibly boring when he gets on his mystical soapbox, but he's also one of the good guys, you know, for sure. And it was very controversial because basically people were like, this is glorifying suicide, and you can imagine what the religious right in America and what the conservative right felt about that and all sorts of things. So it was, and they got a ton of blowback, and there's a little note in the back about that, how they, you know, they had to address it. And actually they did address it by, and I haven't read this, but I got it because it came in a lawn bomb. They did in 92. So this came out in like 1989. It was like late 80s. I don't know. I should know. Sorry. 89, I think it was published. And anyway, in like 92, they did Spider-Man Soul of the Hunter, which is all about essentially Spider-Man, Peter Parker, battling sort of for the soul of Craven. And I think it's their attempt to sort of redress...
appease the Christians.
Yeah, yeah, essentially, in a way that Dematis could feel... okay with. I haven't read it because just haven't got around to it.
Dan Slott brought him back.
Did he? Yeah. Well, no.
I remember him coming back. And his daughter was a hunter.
Oh, he's got a daughter. Yeah, because I think that in Todd McFarlane's supremely overwritten but sort of kind of wonderful story, Torment, which is the first five issues of his Spider-Man run, one of the big hooks is you think Craven's come back. But I think it's his daughter, it turns out to be. So, okay, that's right. And I remember just reading that going, I don't fucking know who that guy is. Who's that? Who's that special caveman? He's interesting. but anyway, it's kind of great. You know, I loved it. I really enjoyed reading it. And it made me sort of think like that. I know I've used this analogy before, but you know how sometimes when you listen to like an incredible like garage rock band record from the 60s where it's like they're at the perfect point where music is exploring what it can do, but everyone's still a super tight session musician really. And they're all like really good at playing their instruments. And so it sounds fucking wicked and recording techniques are getting better, but they're still pretty, you know, they've got that lovely, simple warmth to it and stuff. And so you'll listen to, I don't know, you know, a song or a track by a certain kind of band. And you're like, this is sort of perfect. And although obviously tons of great stuff has followed, it's sort of, in some ways, it's like, this is perfect. And I feel that a bit when I read something like Kraven's Last Hunt. Like, of course there are loads of comics, superhero comics, that are better. And of course, I mean, you know, loads of my favourite ones came after this and stuff like this. But, and of course people still produce interesting stuff. And of course there's like, you know, all that stuff. But there is also a point at which it's like, it's the perfect point at which the tropes have been established. It's playing with those tropes, and yet it's still a monthly comic that's selling gangbusters, but also hasn't got ideas too far above its station. You know what I mean? It's still essentially a Spider-Man comic for kids, really. Yeah. And,
a pretty rare moment. Let's be honest.
And sure, you know, and I think there's, I think with a lot of this pop culture, there is quite a short moment in which it's like, oh, this is it, you know, this is a great time. And, you know, I think there are, I think there's more than one great time for sure. Of course I do. I'm not being a dick about this, but there are moments where it all is like, oh yeah. And one of my problems, you know, with certainly with superhero comics now, is that I do feel a little bit like it, you know, there are really great writers doing good stuff, but it all feels like refining what's been done before. And I think we almost need to get back to a more straight up storytelling adventure mode or something, and just go back to just trying to entertain like 12-year-olds again, actually.
The continuity trap,
it
takes a special person to actually like well, the Immortal Hulk does a good job of, like, I mean, it's pretty much an exercise in continuity play.
Yeah.
But it makes a total slave of writers.
I'm really conflicted about that, because I love the fact that Alan Moore and Grant Morrison know their continuity and can play with it, and like, you know, both of those writers' greatest powers is that they could grab any old duff concept and make it seem great, and also give you these little kind of subtextual nods and stuff, and, oh, that's nice, oh, I see, yeah, he's referring to that, oh, that's great, you know. But actually that isn't, in a way, also like my favorite kind of, like, it is a bit of a trap, as you say, because it's sort of it requires not like, so there's loads of bits where Grant Morrison in some of his comics is doing something really wonderful. And then it's almost like he sort of grinds to a halt a bit, because he's like, I'm making a reference to a comic from 1959. And you're like, oh, well, I didn't know that. So I had no fucking idea who that character was.
When I was doing that clean out, that sort out, like, there's all of these Green Lantern comics that I haven't read.
Right.
And I think one of the last ones I read was, like, I don't know, maybe the third one or something, where it's him and Green Arrow and these the big Green Arrow the big Green Lantern who are sort of being crushed by gravity or something, come into this dimension. And I mean, that was clearly some reference to some
Jack Kirby
Silver Age.
Silver Age Green Arrow story that nobody
and fucking... Yeah, and I was just like, do you know what? I'm gonna keep buying you, and I'm gonna just pop you aside.
Yeah,
it has slid right down the list of priorities.
Yeah, non-essential
because of this shit, basically. Mm. No, I'm quite down. And like listening to this, like the Stan Lee book. I don't know. There's just something about it, like, just the it has turned me into a bit of an Alan Moore, like,
skeptic.
Just at the moment, these the fact that it is built on the exploitation of talented people who saw virtually nothing and who were totally exploited, like. It is a hard thing to ignore.
Yeah. Just because you love the special bright costumes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But then at the same time, there is this sort of like in the disputation. Is that a word?
I know what you mean, so let's say in the disputing.
I know, yeah, but I don't want to be like George W. Bush. You know.
But you already are in so many ways.
Hey, remember him?
Yeah, that great angel. Guy.
Yeah, in the disputing of properties, you see this story that's it's kind of like the official story about the creation of Spider-Man now. Is just it just sort of occurred, you know. If you look at everything, it was just a bunch. It was, you know, three people batting some ideas around, and it just sort of happened, you know. And that is also magical. So yeah, I'm sort of I can see Alan Moore's point. I can see Grant Morrison's point that, you know, superheroes are magic.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, anyway. That sounds good.
Yeah, it was good. It was enjoyable, you know. And I mean, yeah. What about you?
I have read a thing. I thought, oh, it's been a while since I checked out what Matt Howarth has been up to. Because I'm sure that the last time I looked... went to his website and it's just said like under construction or something. He has not. I think Matt Howarth is an odd character because he has MattHowarth.com, and I think there is now a link to where it all happens, Bugtown Mall. .com.
Right.
You go to bugtownmall.com. There is he has been so goddamn busy over these years. All of these years I've been thinking, "Oh, I wonder when Matt Howarth's going to do something again. I wonder if he'll ever do anything again. I wonder what." There is just download after download of stuff, the Post Brothers stuff, Savage Henry-based stuff. Pleasingly, he seems to be doing a bit more... his recent stuff seems to be more Keith Lama stuff.
Oh, which, I discovered
is actually pronounced Keith Yama.
Oh.
Never knew that.
I've never known who
Keith Lama is. Keith Lama is a xenotech. She is.
Oh, it's a she.
yeah. She is a xenotech who she basically communicates in this like ridiculously diverse universe of you know, sentient rocks and. Sentient bacteria in jars, and it's kind of a hard sci-fi thing, really. A lot the pleasure in reading a Keith Yama comic is in the exploration of what sentient life might, you know, might occur as, and how it has the mind-blowing effect of showing the limitations of being human, and how like and how specific it is, you know, when you could be like, I remember one in the original series, the original paper series. These are all like PDFs now, and like I'll get to that in a minute. But there was this it described like this society where like all the females were like these huge like sort of brontosauric type giant things that lived in a sea of fucking, I don't know, nitrogen or something, and the males were you know, I don't know, about the size of a football. you know, it's just the things. It's about imagination, and it's about it's not just an escape from who you are, but it's an escape from humanity. And it has this human character who has a, you know, some sort of, you know, a Babelfish style omni communicator thing, and it's her job to understand these worlds and these societies, these incredibly alien societies, and there's normally some sort of mystery, you know, that sort of thing. The plots are generally sort of... well, anyway, let's talk about Vectors. What he's done is, because there's... I don't know if you heard about this, there's a global pandemic.
No, I don't know. He's, but I'll catch up. That's fine.
Yeah. You'll catch up when you catch up on your News 24 box set.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. It gets quite good around... well, it's good up until... sort of 2011.
Right. Yeah, I'm still the Olympics 92, are good. So I'll get there.
Yeah. Blur win.
good.
he's giving away some stuff for free. So go to bugtownmall.com if you want to read some Keith Yammer, a couple of Keith Yammer PDFs.
Yeah.
The PDFs, you download them as a zip, and then you unzip them, and then they're in, like, sort of... They're in several bits. I don't know, like 16 bits or something, each with six pages or something. So it's a bit... That's a bit odd. Another thing that's odd, that he is just, you know, requires Acrobat Reader 5 or higher. 104 pages, you know, these are the listings. $10. For a digital download. You go down the list. He's still apparently selling a lot of things on CD. You get the PDF on a CD. 37 pages for the Contaminated Zone issue 1. It's a $3 download or you can order on CD.
I love the idea of someone being like, oh, I've got a CD then if I can.
And this is something he was always like around about whenever comic shops stopped stocking his stuff. There was this sort of he would advertise like you could he's written loads of novels as well. He's written loads of sci-fi novels.
I can see this. I'm looking now.
And there were sci-fi novels that you could buy on a floppy disk. that you'd read, you know, on your PC. So in some ways, he was sort of a pioneer of this cyber thing that we're all living in now. But in other ways, he's kind of... It's like he's completely ignored the way things are done.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway... So that's a bit weird and eccentric. I also, like, flicking down, I also saw, the great thing about Keith Yammer, just young woman with ridiculous amount of responsibility, and she's the protagonist, and she's never sexualized or anything like this. It's all about, like, this sort of really expansive view of reality. And down there is there's a risque business, a limited edition 8-page mini comic featuring a portfolio of risque Keith Yammer drawings by Matt Howarth. You must be over 21 or you must be over 21 years old to order this.
Wow, that's...
Oh, that's a bit late 80s, 90s, isn't it?
There's so much stuff.
And that is, like, that's really sort of anomalous to, like, the rest of it. Sort of undermines the character a bit, I thought. Not that I've downloaded it and looked at it
at all. And whacked off to it.
Yeah, and had great big massive wank all over it.
I like the look of the mic.
Massive wank.
The mic legacy. I'm just looking at this endless list of weird comics from another fucking reality.
Yeah.
The mic legacy, a digital reprinting of the three Mike, the ultimate collector, mini comics by Howarth in the 1980s. Order on CD. Okay, I will. It's 25 pages, black and white. I'll order it on CD. It's the idea. But it's kind of wonderful. It's like, I mean, my God, he's so productive.
Yeah, yeah. He does. He's doing a lot of, you know, the thing about like older creators and getting hold of Photoshop.
Yeah.
It looks like there's a touch of that. I need to reserve judgment though, because there's this other Keith Lama relic which I haven't downloaded and read yet, but that's basically, I prefer his black and white, which what Vectors is. Keith has been assigned to work on an ambitious Skyweb orbital habitat structure. So it's this sort of web of sort of organic stuff that's surrounding a planetoid, which is built for as being a habit, a place that people can live. And it's sort of so it's techno-organic, so it's sort of growing, it's being grown, but it's huge. It sort of, you know, wraps itself around this thing, and there's all sorts of different workers who are all different, like big and small beings, and it's a big complicated structure, and it's sort of broken down into a civil war, but it's told really well. It is, it just doesn't feel like any other comic, really. His stuff doesn't feel like anything else. It doesn't feel, it's just not derivative. The story itself is sort of like, okay, so you've got different factions vying for control of a thing. And also the thing itself becomes sentient, which adds a complication, and she's just there and she sort of brokers a deal, and this is what the stories are always about, like just sort of finding compromise and common ground between the most alien of things, and that's why I like it. It's good. Oh, hello. Have you gone?
Hello.
Hello.
Right. Oh, what the fuck happened there?
My phone went dead. I didn't realise for ages. I thought I was being boring.
You were. You bored your own phone to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. And that's Keith Yama.
Yay!
I don't know at what point...
I heard every word.
You got... yeah.
I heard every word, but enough. I just was really bored by it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah.
I've been buying Deadlines online. Mm. That's a thing. Back to Margaret Robert. And her... Because she's producing a Tank Girl film.
Okay. Well, the time could be right for it to work.
Yeah, because Margaret Robert is such
a big
such
star.
A name now, because of, you know, her work in Neighbours. Early Deadlines are going really up in price. But I know about this because I've been trying to buy Deadlines online. And I got one. I can't remember what number it was, but it had no Philip Bond, no Brett Ewan, none of the original lot. And I just realised it still had like Tank Girl on the cover, and it had a little feature inside about how it's going to be a film. and but Hewlett and Martin were nowhere to be seen inside, and I don't think Philip Bond was in there. And just how much it had sort of lost its identity. It was kind of like, what is this?
So there's a bit. This is a good segue into this, actually. So basically, after Dylan and Ewins passed on the editorial reins, it was picked up by Cy Spencer. And just need to point out that Cy Spencer died this week unexpectedly. So RIP Cy Spencer. That's really sad. And like he wrote some stuff for like Vertigo and things like that. And I'm going to be honest, and he wrote for Judge Dredd, the magazine stuff. I've read some stuff I've quite enjoyed, but I was very sad because he was the editor of Deadline for the time that I got into Deadline. So once the Black Bar Down the Side original run had kind of transmogrified into the more second Summer of Love, Hewlett running rampant, Bond, Glyn Dillon, all those kind of band covers and Hugo Tate, you know, Fireball, Cheeky Wee Budgie Boy, that time. That was under the editorial steership of Cy Spencer, and he had this kind of really funny, irreverent, sort of shitty, give a fuck tone, which I really liked because I remember being like, oh, I'm kind of getting older now, and I don't need a Tharg. I like this kind of bratty, kind of hipster, not hipster, but like it was like hanging out with the older brother's mates or something. It was cool. Anyway, like he was kind of the editor for that period. And then I think a guy called Frank Wynne or something edited it when...
I think he was the publisher.
Oh, okay. But there was definitely a point at which they sunk all their money into the Tank Girl film and it was still going. And I remember picking up an issue and it, like you say, it had no one in it. It was, I think the best thing it had going for it was that it was still reprinting Hernandez Brothers, maybe.
Reprinting them, Nabil Kanan's.
That's Exit. Right, Exit was in there and stuff like that.
Ed Hillier's End of the Century Club as well.
Oh,
which never got to finish.
Right. I didn't know that was in there. I always thought he self published that. Oh, okay.
He popped up at the end because they were mining the small press, basically sort of vibrant small press around that time, which is what happened with Tank Girl with Hewlett and Martin. They sort of went along that with the same sort of MO, and obviously wasn't always as fruitful.
It's actually kind of just you said that, and I've gone to eBay just because I'm interested, and actually it's kind of ridiculous. Everything's going for Deadline magazine number one, £375. Someone's trying to get for it. I mean, you could get
Look at the sold prices. They're actually still going for quite a lot.
But for so long you've been able to get like issues of Deadline for 50p. Like no one gave a shit about them. I've got nearly not a full run, but I've got a full run almost of the ones that I care about. So sort of from about 1 to 35 or something, I've got pretty much all of those. And yeah, I mean, apart from the ones I bought at the time, I don't think I paid anything for those. You know, I'd go to Krypton Comics and there'd just be like a shitload of Deadlines, and you know, he wanted 50p each of those. And it's really funny. It's like that, or everything on there now is like £500. I think I've actually got two copies of number one. I might try and flog it. It's like,
do it. In my sort out, I actually dropped them off with Lorne this morning to sell for me. They'll be turning up on Lorne's selling page at some point.
Right, yeah, I'll
or maybe
buy
you'll
them.
Just flog them on it on eBay. Yeah, issues 2, 3, and 4. I had doubles of those. No, it's odd. Yeah, my ongoing this will be an ongoing thing, dear listener. My my fascination with Deadline. Oh, hello. Hello, Crackles. What are you doing?
Oh, I don't know. Nothing. It's just crackling. Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I don't know what that's about. I can hear you. Can you hear me? Hello?
Dear listener, it sounds like the Beast Must Die has dropped his headpiece down a toilet.
No, I can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Oh, my headphones might be going funny. All right, fuck it.
That was very odd.
Yeah.
I'm just getting all your messages about, where are you?
Yeah.
There we go.
Now I've just seen Deadline. That's a good one. Someone wants £602 for it, for Deadline number one on eBay. I think they'll get that, don't you?
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. Because Margaret Robert is going to do a film of it. Yeah. Not interested in that. How do you? Oh man, yeah. It can't be a film. You can never. Not really. Not really.
It's not. There's not really a good enough idea there. You know, there is no idea because it starts off as a sort of post Brendan McCarthy kind of caper, sci-fi caper, with loads of shit jokes about Australia. But, like, very quickly, it's just, like, Alan Martin and Jamie Hewlett's kind of weird, like, diary almost, isn't it? Like, just whatever is on their mind. And suddenly they're all going on holiday to Worthing guest houses and fucking having, like, carry-on-style adventures. And, you know, it's the joy of Tank Girl has always been that it just followed its own muse completely.
But I was speaking to Lorne this morning. He worked in the Brighton Virgin Megastore comics concession as a youngster, and he was there when Hewlett and Martin came in with their Atom Tan issue one, saying like, "Oh, you know, would you put some of our comics in,
right,
in your shop?" And he was like, "Yeah, all right, yeah." He ended up selling. I think he got about £500 for Atom Tan. He sold them to go to all tomorrow's parties,
right,
along with an original Simon Bisley Doom Patrol cover. hopefully, he had a good weekend. Yeah. But like those Atom Tans, they're worth like about, you know, grand and a half now.
Right. Yeah.
Like that would have been like probably two weekends.
So
this end of Deadline, I'm quite interested in that now. I'm going to continue investigating. So this is an in progress thing.
An in progress and, project.
Yes. And also, of course, dear listener, Paul John Milne's Grave Horticulture. Can't get issue one anymore, but if you've got issue, you can get issue two. It's very odd. It's got odder with issue three. There's a lot of this sort of, it's almost medieval, a lot of it. There's this page after page of like unbelievably striking imagery. I haven't finished it yet, and can't honestly say I'm entirely sure what's going on, because I haven't gone, obviously, with a year, well, it's over a year since the last one. It's not all present in my mind, but there's these pages of like, it has this sort of medieval, sort of hierarchical perspective where everything's running into each other and some things are bigger than others. And it's unbelievable. It's like nothing else, and it is amazing. And there are lots of funny lines in it, and I can't finish Passing Judgment because I haven't read it. But, yeah, but it's got a fantastic quote by me on the back of it.
Well, and there you go.
I think that's what makes it, really. That's what makes it. I think this is the first time I've finally got quoted on the back of a comic. Yeah, had to be a fucking self-published small press thing, didn't it?
Yeah, right.
What a load of shit.
I know. And it's only because you pressured him into it. You basically bullied him into doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, I guilted him into it. The worthless piece of shit.
Now he's done a comic, can't even freaking finish.
Oh, I can't finish it because I'm so tired all the time.
No, I mean, his stuff is fucking amazing and like dinner. It's like you've got to just got to pace yourself with it, really. I still maintain, though, I love Grave Horticulture, but I really, really, really liked Hardships, his sci-fi thing. I think Hardships is, I think that's his best thing, actually. And he's done a lot of good things, but my personal favourite is Hardships. But I have not read Grave Horticulture number 3 yet, so I need to shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up, buddy!
We probably need to revisit this. Well, I mean, would you like to talk about one more thing before we go?
I was going to talk at length about Multiversity, but I'm going to save that because I reread Multiversity. I had lots of big thoughts on it, but I need to go back and have a good old think about it. And I'll actually get you to have a think about it before, so we can actually have a decent chat about it.
Yeah, all right. Well, hopefully we'll reconvene. We'll reconvene soon.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
But what I will quickly talk about, very quickly, is one of my recent eBay rabbit hole purchases has been getting hold of issues of the 1989 Huntress series, right? And this was just because on a whim I picked up a kind of Justice League International special about the Huntress, which...
it's the usual whim.
Yeah, it is.
Isn't
the
it?
Usual
like,
whim, yeah.
I remember those adverts and thinking, oh, I wonder what that's like.
Yeah, exactly. And now I've scratched that itch. And I've never really cared about the Huntress. I didn't understand even her kind of convoluted back history that she was in, you know, before the crisis, she was Batman and Catwoman's daughter or something like that, I think. Helena Wayne, and she became the Huntress, and then obviously the crisis came along and said no, and so she became, they wanted to keep her around, so she kind of was reinvented as Helena Bertinelli, who's the daughter of a mob boss who becomes the Huntress and hangs out in Gotham. And like I say, on a whim, I got the Justice League International focusing on her, which was kind of like a soft launch for the series. And the reason I've picked up a bunch of these, though, is that the art is fucking amazing, which is Joe Staton, who is an artist who I've liked, but always was a bit like, ah, yeah, he's just kind of work for hire American dude, you know, whatever. It's on the special, I think it's like Mark Nelson helps out with it. But on the series, I don't know who's doing it. It might just be him. But it's using like duotone stuff. So it's kind of, Joe Staton's art is like really angular and stylized. It's kind of, it's like an amalgamation of like Ian Gibson and Mark Badger, but with a sort of, a bit of Chaykin and a bit of that sort of chunky design sense of like Rick Burchett, Howard Chaykin, Walt Simonson. It's got that kind of chunky dynamism that they've got going on. It's just absolutely great. Like, and it's got this really cool duotone effect on it. So it looks like nothing else of the time in a way. It's sort of astounding. And it's really nice when you find a new artist who's not a new artist, he's someone who's been around for ages. But it's like when I got into Mark Badger, because I'd always looked at his art and gone like, I don't really like that, it's really weird and it makes me feel a bit annoyed. And then I suddenly clicked. I was like, oh, actually, no, he's amazing. And then suddenly I just wanted everything that Mark Badger had done. And this was sort of a similar impact where I was like, hold on a minute, this guy's fucking awesome. And I would just look up, you know, some pages on Google for Joe Staton and the Huntress and just see if you can find what I'm talking about. You don't have to do it now. I'm just saying, like, you know, for the listeners as well. And it's such a great looking comic, and it's pretty well written. It's good. It's interesting, but that's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is the art to me. It's just fucking great. And it comes out of that. The other person that I get a bit of a vibe is Tim Sale as well. A little bit of, yeah, he's like a lot of,
all right.
Or even like, I don't know. He's like a load of people. It's really dynamic and really cool. And what's interesting about The Huntress as well, this series, is that issue 6 is the last issue before issue 7 becomes like a suggestive for mature readers title. And the weird thing is, they sort of mention in the letter column, oh, we're going to go to new format. So a bit like what happened with like things like Doom Patrol, and, you know, where they suddenly were like, oh, actually, it's a mature readers comic now. Although I think Doom Patrol did for a few issues, but it doesn't go to new format. It remains like what they call the newsstand format, which is like unfortunate because newsstand format paper is that sort of bog rolly horrible paper that most comics were printed on from our youth.
Which I prefer for some things.
Yeah, and it's got its own thing, and it does sort of work for this. It keeps it kind of nice and ground level, but the sort of quality of the art that is on display does actually warrant a bit nicer paper. But it's interesting that they sort of say, oh, we're going to new format and we're going to go to suggested for materials, but they don't even mention really that they're kind of changing to that. And reading the issues, it's like, it's not really clear. It's a bit like, I don't know, it's a bit like a, it's like there's not actually any real reason. And now I don't think this would have any kind of warning on it. It's just like that level of grit would be completely de rigueur. In fact, much worse stuff probably happens in a regular Batman comic. But at the time, they obviously felt that they wanted to start dealing in slightly more adult territory. So it's one of the few times.
Or it was just a sales thing.
Maybe. Like, I don't know whether... It's really hard to know.
It's the same comic, but just like pretend it's for, you know...
Maybe. I mean, I don't know, though, because that sort of... I mean, in some ways, yeah. I mean, it's Andy Helfer and Kevin Dooley editing, and they're the guys who did... you know who Andy Helfer is, but they were responsible for the Justice League revamp and a load of other stuff. So they had a kind of bit of a kind of gold touch for a while. But it's interesting, you know, like this direct newsstand format comic that's suggested for mature readers. And, it's just... It's to someone like me, like a format nerd from DC Comics from the late 80s. There's a few of us out there, all right. It's quite an anomaly because actually, I don't think that there were any other times that a suggestion for mature readers wasn't given a special shiny format, and it's odd. Yeah, but it's actually a really great comic. If you can like find an issue or two for 50p somewhere, I really think it's worth getting just to have a look at the art and the sort of page design and stuff. It's really cool. Like, really...
Can you, like, read us a single issue? Is it, like, you've got an A story that's resolved in an issue and then a B story that's going, in an arc?
It's still in that model. It's a bit like it's sort of being published around the time that, you know, Alan Grant's writing Batman and the Justice League and stuff. So it's not moved into that kind of serialized form or the sort of novelized form that we, you know, it became. So and also it's just one of those things where I've got that, you know, that thing now where often I will buy something just for the art, just to look at it, just to sort of like enjoy the pages, really. I'm not that bothered about it. Although Joey Cavalieri, who writes it, who was, I think, an editor for Superman, he's mainly an editorial voice in DC. But he's pretty decent, actually. Like, it's actually, it's kind of got its own flavour, and it's not really clunky. It doesn't read really bad. It's quite dense, and it's quite considered, and, you know, it's not... like dynamite, I'm not going to blow you away, but it's definitely like a cut above a lot of other dog shit that was being published at the time. It's just a bit of a treat, really. A bit of a sort of, and it's nice when you go, oh, yeah, that, is that any good? And it's like, yeah, it is. it's worth a look. And you know, another tick in the box, Gary Lactus, another tick in the box.
I was thinking, like, you know, you get these labels, like, you know, suggested for mature readers and
mature things like
that. I think in a lot of world comics these days, the Beast Must Die.
Yeah,
they could put a special impenetrable label on.
Warning: impenetrable.
Warning: impenetrable. Warning: will not make any sense unless you are one of a dying breed of men in their 60s who have read too many comics and wasted their lives.
Warning.
A big W for wasted life. Warning.
Yeah.
That'd be good. Let's leave the review universe.
Two W's, warning, wasted life.
See, you could pitch them against each other in the WWL.
The warning, wasted they
could,
life.
Yeah, please. They could just argue points of continuity into the grave, and we could watch. But who is the fool or the fool who follows him?
Exactly. That's a really good point.
The fool who follows him, as I often point out, or the fool who follows him.
Yes, the fool. I think the fool is the fool.
Let's go now from Review Universe away from. Away from the review universe. I've been singing away from the review universe. I don't know when we got cut off.
Let's just say it's happening now.
Okay, we're going away from the review universe. No.
No. That was like Philip Glass. I enjoyed that.
Cool. Yeah, I am like Philip Glass. Philip Glass was a wrestler.
Was he?
Yes, he was. He was a wrestler. And you know, obviously avant-garde composer. At one point he was debuting some minimalist, you know, stuff on his organ. There was a guy who didn't like it because it was new and repetitive and got up on stage in protest. Philip Glass took one hand off the keyboard, punched him spark out, and continued playing.
Is that true?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes.
That's great. I love it. I love two-fisted musicians. I love two-fisted avant-garde musicians.
Yeah, Philip Glass, he's like the Jack Kirby of... composers. Yeah.
He said to the guy, "You've got a Philip Glass jaw." Smacked him one.
Yeah. And Philip Glass is in town. He's in town. Everyone's got a Philip Glass jaw because he's nails.
Steve Reich, fucking barroom brawler. Total brawler. Pisshead brawler.
Absolutely. Steve Reich. A dangerous murderer.
John Adams. Fucking tasty in a rumble. That's what they say.
Yeah.
Okay.
David Byrne. Yeah. David Byrne, spelt differently, more like David. Fucking psycho.
David Chinese.
Fucking psycho.
David Chinese Byrne. More like.
Yeah. Yeah, that was his special move. And then he'd actually set people on fire.
Yeah, also...
Music for the knee plays. Music for the knee to the groin plays, more like.
It's music for the knee plays, but it's when you jump from the corner of the ring and landed on someone's groin with your knee. That's the fucking knee play.
Plays, yeah. Oh, I see today that Richard Herring's lost a testicle. I hope it's not. He's been. Yeah, he's written. I don't know. Is it? I've been reading through. I looked through his blog. Is it testicular cancer? I mean, I'm assuming so.
Well, I mean, yeah, he hasn't said, but I mean, it feels like. I mean, it's as good a guess as anything, man his age.
Yeah.
The result being that. So yeah, I hope he's okay.
Yeah, me too.
That reminds me, though, as a quick recommend, since we're in the recommend section.
King Rocker.
Stuart Lee's, documentary, King Rocker, is very good. Have you seen it?
No, I really want to. Yeah, no, I have no time to watch anything ever, unless it's Neighbours. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could just not watch Neighbours and then watch someone else. That would help.
Well, no, I don't know. I don't think Lady Lactus has any interest in watching King Rocker.
Well,
I don't watch Neighbours. Neighbours is on, and whilst I'm drawing... A milkman.
Don't lie. You love Neighbours. It's your life. But anyway, it's very good. It's a portrait of the lead singer of the Nightingales, Robert Lloyd, and Nightingales being a sort of a cult post-punk band from Birmingham who've essentially never, ever, ever sort of sold out, despite some attempts to do so. It's a really good portrait of single-minded artist art for art's sake, and a really sort of genuinely unpretentious like person making art. And yeah, it sounds like cliche to say it's life affirming, but it sort of is, because it's unromantic, and yet it is also you kind of come out of it going, I'm so glad that there's people like that doing that. And I'm cycling towards. It's like, you know, the act of creation, and if a few people like it, that's a really good thing, isn't it? That's okay.
It's all you can ask for. Really.
Yeah, and actually, I just sort of am like, life is, life's complicated enough that if you get a bit of that as well, that's pretty good, don't have to make a living from it or be famous from it and whatever. It's like actually just ploughing on and doing it, and the people that like it, you know. It's a bit like what Matt Howarth is doing. His fan base must be small but probably reasonably dedicated, and he's got
small,
to do it.
Small but with lots of $10.
Big CD fans. Lots of big CD fans. Anyway, recommended. It's good. It's a good documentary, and Stuart Lee is a good sort of host for that as well. It's nice.
Yeah. I was being a bit flippant. I would have watched it if I had subscribed to some Murdoch thing.
If you were willing to suck the cock of Murdoch, which you're not, more power to you, brother.
Some sort of illegal download of it or something like that. What I would do is find an illegal download, and then there would be a little site where I could give the director and Stuart Lee just a bit of money.
Yeah, it's kind of annoying.
Directly.
It's not... it's just annoying that it's on Sky Arts, considering Stuart Lee's position on a lot of this stuff. Anyway, okay, yeah, it's on Sky Arts.
Sky Arts, yes, they're excellent. Annoying. That's where I still haven't paid. It was Sky Arts that showed the documentary about my dad, and I'm still not giving them money. I don't care. I do not care. I'm not going to pay you money. Certainly not to watch some old bloke who's into spanners.
Yeah.
All right. So, dear listener, I feel like this has been an odd one.
Yeah.
But I hope you have been sated by what we have offered you. I appreciate that The Beast Must Die has largely carried this episode.
This episode?
Fucking hero. But trust me, someday soon the tide will turn and I, Gary Lactus, shall have read some comics which he shall then in turn talk about in great detail with fantastic eloquence.
Even though here. He hasn't read them.
Next time, here on Silence. It's nice, just nice to be in the car and be able to shout. Couldn't do that in the flat. Sorry, spaceship.